only way to enjoy life is to work. Work is much more fun than fun.
You want to work with me?
Yes, Mr. Gale.
Jake.
Yes, sir.
Now beat it.
Thank you.
My name is Trindad, and I'm going to sing to you.
You lucky people.
Yes, quote, unquote, another edition of the quizzical quotation game, devised and introduced by Nigel Rees.
Hello again. This week our panel consists of Larry Adler, Graham Garden, Benny Green and Norma Shepherd, and Ronald Fletcher is here once more to read the quotations for us. And without further ado, we'll launch into a round of slogans. A slogan is defined by the Oxford English Dictionary as the distinctive note, phrase, cry, etc. of any person or body of persons. So, Benny Green, can you tell me with what person or body of persons you would associate this distinctive phrase here expressed in note form?
Love you madly, right or wrong, just by the lyrics of a song. It's a song by Duke Ellington, and that was his motto, love you madly.
Do you know how it came about, or how he used to use it?
He used to come on the stage and use the royal we and say, we love you madly.
Yes, we'd like you to know that the guys in the band all love you madly.
Oh, that was a Baroque extension later on. On the rare occasions he was on talking terms with all the members of the band.
Right, moving on to Graham Garden. This next slogan was sent in by one of our listeners, Mr. Ramsay Burt of Leeds, as one of his favourite quotations.
You too can have a body like mine.
I don't know whether he was referring to himself, I don't know.
Well, Ramsay Burt of Leeds, I think that was the quote attributed to Charles Atlas, who allegedly started his life foolishly lying about on beaches, having sand kicked in his eyes.
As a 6 stone weekly.
As a 7 stone weekly.
Yes.
But he'd obviously got fat lying about on the sand.
The rest of the advertising copy, I was a skinny, timid weakling of only 7 stone. I didn't know what real health or strength were. I was afraid to fight, ashamed to be seen in a bathing costume. Right, 2 marks to you, Graham. Norma, another advertising slogan for you. There is a brand of syrup, or treacle, depending on which part of the country you come from, which carries the slogan,
out of the strong came forth sweetness.
Oh, dear. Let me think. You want the brand name?
No, I don't. It's the last thing I want is the brand name. I would like to know where the quotation comes from. General area would do.
Guess. Shakespeare.
No. Offer it to the others.
Charles Atlas, when he stopped kicking sand.
It's something to do with bees, isn't it?
Bees and lions. It's from the Book of Judges. Out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. Well, no marks for anybody there. Larry had a few, a political slogan of sorts.
Would you buy a used car from this man?
Well, it was said by a man who I absolutely revere, Mort Saul. And it was one of the greatest political jokes I ever heard. In fact...
Said about whom first?
About Richard Nixon, and America did buy a used car from Nixon. They bought a used Ford from him. Can I just revert to something both Graham and Benny said? Woody Allen said that he tried to take Charles Atlas's course, found he couldn't make it, and thought it was cheaper just to pay Atlas to walk home with him every night.
And now away from slogans to some more general sayings, I'd like just to know who said them. Benny Green.
I have lived 78 years without hearing of bloody places like Cambodia.
That sounds like whoever was the British Foreign Secretary at the time of the trouble.
Well, you're getting warm. It was 1953. Next to the British Foreign Secretary, you would have...
Nobody, usually. It wouldn't be Churchill.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Winston Churchill. Said it about Cambodia. I've lived 78 years without hearing of bloody places like that. And that was according to his doctor, Lord Morin. Graham Gard, moving on to you.
Mother, give me the sun.
Mother, give me the sun. Yes, I know where it comes from, which is very annoying, because otherwise I could have made up a joke about it.
Well, let's have the joke first, explanation afterwards.
Well, no, I know what it is. I can't be bothered to make up jokes, because I know the answer. It comes from... It's the last, or really nearly the last line of Ibsen's Ghosts.
Mm. Do you know the name of the character?
No, I don't. But no. He's the son of the person he's talking to.
I think his name was Oswald.
Oswald Alving, or Alving, yeah. Not Rupert Murdoch, as I'm sure you were going to say. Mother, give me the son. 2 marks, Sir Graham. Norma.
In a hierarchy, every employee tends to rise to his level of incompetence.
Oh, my goodness, who would have said that? Parkinson.
Well, it's that sort of territory, isn't it? But in fact, it wasn't Parkinson.
The Peter Principle?
Yes. Yeah. Well done, Larry. The Peter Principle by Lawrence J. Peter and Raymond Howe. Book published in 1969 contained this pronouncement. In a hierarchy, every employee tends to rise to his level of incompetence. Larry Adler, a clip from a film soundtrack for you.
Hey, you mind if I make myself comfortable? My shirt is sticking.
Please do.
Be comfortable. That's my motto, up where I come from.
It's mine, too.
Well, I guess I'm going to strike you as being the unrefined type, huh?
The unrefined type.
There never was a film star named Brown Sugar, was there?
We're back to Art of the Strong Came Full Sweetness again.
No, I don't know what that is.
You didn't recognize the voice of the actor.
The unrefined. Cagney?
No, offer it to the others.
Well, I can't recognize the flavor of the dialogue, but it sounded through that not very clear recording, a bit like Groucho Marx.
No, I'd have to tell you, it was Marlon Brando.
Well, that explains it.
As Kowalski in A Streetcar Named Desire by.
There was a
Williams.
Picture of Brando in the paper this morning, and it was captioned in one of our biggest papers, Marlo Brandon.
No.
Probably the Sunday Tomes.
Yes. Back to Benny Green.
I'm not really a Jew, just Jewish. Not the whole hog, you know.
Now, I was present when whoever said that said it. And I can't quite place who it was. It was somebody I was with. And,
there were lots of other people there as well. And he kept on saying it.
He did indeed, yes, whoever it was.
Ruled out Moses.
No, it was somebody much, much younger than Moses.
Much younger than Moses. Larry.
Jonathan Miller in Beyond the Fringe.
Yes, quite so.
By the way, did you know that there was a financier named Otto Kahn, very famous Jewish financier, but he converted to Christianity, and one day he was walking up Fifth Avenue with another financier who happened to be a hunchback, and they came to the Temple Emmanuel Synagogue, and Kahn said, you know, I used to be a Jew, and the other man said, yeah, I used to be a hunchback.
I wonder if you remember the little part of Beyond the Fringe in which the remark occurred.
I wonder how many of these people have realised that Jonathan Miller's a Jew. I suppose he gets away with it because of his ginger hair, actually. I'd rather be working class than be a Jew. Oh, any day. But think of the awful situation if you were... working class and a Jew.
There's always somebody worse off than yourself.
In fact, I'm not really a Jew, just Jewish, not the whole hog, you know.
Well, now, Graham Gardner struggling to get out of this song sung by Ringo Starr is a familiar phrase. Where did the phrase wine, women, and song originate?
I did once go to a doctor who said that I should lay off wine and women, but the odd song shouldn't hurt. but I don't know where the quotation comes from originally. Wine, women, and song.
I don't think you'd ever guess it in a thousand years, actually. It originated by or around Martin Luther. Who loves
nothing about all three.
Who loves not woman, wine, and song remains a fool his whole life long. This is attributed to Luther. It's written in the Luther room at Wartburg, but no proof exists of its authorship. Just thought I'd throw that one in just to Fox Graham Garden. Norm Isher, for you.
I am extremely fond of all children, except boys.
Lewis Carroll.
Yes, Lewis Carroll, sir.
Do I get one?
Yes. That was by Lewis Carroll. Not quite as bad as W.C. Fields, who, when asked whether he liked children, replied, boiled or fried. Finally, in this round, for you, Larry Adler.
Every director bites the hand that lays the golden egg.
I don't know who said that.
No?
Harry Cohen laid everything except golden eggs, but I don't think he said that.
It must be Sam Goldwyn.
Yes, it's a Goldwynism. Every director bites the hand that lays the golden egg. Do you have any favourite Goldwynisms, Benny?
Well, one of the famous ones is about the guy that came to him and told Mr. Goldwyn that his wife had just had a boy, and Goldwyn said, what are you calling the kid? And he said, we're going to call him William. And Goldwyn, his reporter, said, William, what kind of a name's that? Every Tom, Dick and Harry's called William. I haven't come to the punchline yet. That much is always in the books, but what actually was said after that was, the fella said, well, what should we call him if we don't call him William? And Goldwyn said, why don't you call him Bill?
Did you hear about the butcher in Hollywood who had a notice in his window saying, director's brains, $10 a pound, writer's brains, $2 a pound? And a writer got very furious about this and went in and said, look, why are writer's brains only $2 a pound? And he said, well, think of how many directors you've got to kill to get a pound of brains.
I was a stooge for Eddie Cantor when I was about 15 years old, and I was a stooge merely because I looked like him. And he was trying to think all day of a wire to send to Irving Thalberg and Norma Shearer when they had their first child, and he really agonized over this. Finally, he sent this, and I can remember very well. Congratulations on your latest production. I'm sure it will look better after it's been cut.
What was that Dorothy Parker wire to a woman that had a baby after 10 and a half months pregnancy? We always knew you had it in you, wasn't it?
There we did, yeah.
Let me just glance at the score at the moment, and it tells me, looking at the score, that Benny Green and Larry Adler are tying neck and neck at the moment. Because you can't really tie any other way. Anyway, at this point, we pause, and I invite the panel to tell us if they have a favourite quotation or quotations that they're very fond of, and they're always quoting, perhaps which has some special meaning for them. Benny Green, what's yours?
Without any question, Groucho Marx. I haven't any idea what it means, but it's my favourite quote, and it's, you've got to get up early if you want to get out of bed.
Graham Garden, what's your favourite quotation?
Well, at the risk of raising the tone, it's a quotation.
Never fear, Graham.
It's a quotation that we keep hearing these days. There's a rod to beat our medical profession for not doing the right thing with heart-lung machines. It's the old thing, thou shalt not kill, but needst not strive officiously to keep alive, which actually originally was written as a joke. by a chap called Arthur Hugh Clough, and it's part of a series called The Latest Decalogue. And what's now become rather a po-faced and pious remark is actually in the company of things like "Thou shalt not steal an empty feat when it's so lucrative to cheat." So that's where it comes from. I just thought I'd put you all right in a
yes.
sobering moment there.
Common misquotation, perhaps. Norma, what have you brought along this week?
Well, I'm going to raise the tone even further because I've got St. Augustine. And I quote this a lot because it applies to everybody's diets and giving up smoking and all those other sins of the flesh. And it's this: give me chastity and continence, but not just now. Or as somebody like Mae West said, I'm not sure who it was, I am pure as the driven slush.
Harry Adler, what's your favourite quotation?
Dorothy Parker's my favourite one. They used to play a game at the round table at the Algonquin. And this sentence, give us a sentence using the word horticulture. She says, you can lead a horticulture, but you can't make her think.
Can I just add that we've now had four quotes, one from each of us, which qualifies for another quote. Groucho Marx, again, is four quotes make a gallon, just remember.
Well, since we started this series, we've been delighted to receive a tremendous response from listeners at home who've sent in their favourite quotations, and I've got some with me. But first of all, a grovelling apology. When we were talking about the common misquotation, "All that glitters is not gold," which should be "All that glisters is not gold," I said it was a quote from Thomas Gray. Well, several million people have written in to point out that it occurs also elsewhere, like Gerald Stonehill from SW10.
You were wrong. Do not rely on books of quotations. See Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. "All that glisters is not gold." Often have you heard that told. Also in Bacon's Relics of Rome, "All is not gold that glistereth." Also found in Milton.
Indeed, indeed. It goes back as far as Aesop's fables, so I hope Honor is satisfied. My apologies for getting it wrong, and I shan't rely on books of quotations again, because all the main ones just attribute that saying to Gray. Mrs. Mary Helps writes from Barkingside, Ilford. There's a mere mum surrounded, she says, by a gifted family. Her favourite quotation is from Barry's play Mary Rose.
"I know I'm not clever, but I'm always right."
There you are, mums. You can put that up in the kitchen. And Ursula Smith writes from Evreux in France, where we also have listeners, it seems, having heard us talking about menus and quotations to put on menus in an earlier programme. She said these gastronomic delicacies appeared on a menu in Paris some years ago. First,
raped carrots.
And second, a fish dish,
God whipped in cream.
But our thanks to everybody who's written in. We'll have more another time. Right, and now moving penultimately on to some places in this next round. Ronald Fletcher is going to read you some pithy descriptions of places. I simply want to know what the place referred to is. And if you don't know, you can always guess wildly. Benny Green, from which English city is
the shortest way out, notoriously, a bottle of Gordon's gin?
Oh, Manchester.
Mm. How did you know that?
Oh, well, that's a very famous quotation to excuse the Dictionary of the Working Classes to cheap gin in the 19th century. It was such an awful place. I'm not sure who said it. It might have been Engels.
Well, no, it was Hector Bolitho. Oh, it was a bit later than the 19th century. Died in 1930. Would you apply it to any other city? I mean, are you willing to give offence to our listeners in Manchester?
Well, I think that it's so long since I visited a lot of these towns that I don't suppose it applies anymore. But I remember once waking up in the middle of the night in Newcastle, being convinced that I was being punished for some terrible sin that I couldn't remember, and this was hell. It may have had something to do with the fact that around about that time, Newcastle beat my team in the cup final 1-0. And I never really forgiven them.
Somewhere else for you, Graham Garden.
Great God, this is an awful place.
Great God, this is an awful place. Well, where do you start, really? Into small. Hastings off season. thank God, this is an awful place.
It's a federal unknown quotation, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Not the sort of place you'd go to for a holiday at all.
But it's probably been used about so many other places. It's not somewhere like the Crimea. Or...
No. Anybody know?
W.C. Field, speaking of Philadelphia.
It's about Saddle. Going to Scott in his diary in January 1912. Great God, this is an awful place. Norma, can you finish this saying off?
Good Americans, when they die, go to...
Paris.
Yes, Paris, according to... to a gentleman called Thomas Appleton. Oscar Wilde added... Ben?
I don't know what he added. I just thought how very unhygienic.
He added, bad Americans go to America.
Yes. Oscar Wilde in A Woman of No Importance, Lady Hunt stands and asks, and when bad Americans die, where do they go to? Lord Illingworth replies, oh, they go to America. Finally, to our resident American. Are you an American or a British resident?
No, I'm still American. I still have my American passport.
Right.
But, you know, whenever I come, I've lived here since 1949. Whenever I come through the customs, I say, hello, Mr. Radler, visiting us again?
Well, finally, can you recognize this place? I'm sure you can. Perhaps you can tell me who cabled home from which city?
Streets full of water. Please advise.
Robert Benchley did to Harold Ross of the New Yorker.
About where?
About Venice. Where
yes.
else?
Venice. Streets full of water. Please advise.
Incidentally, I know why the immigration men give me that visitor bit. It's because although I've lived here since 1949, I talk as if I don't arrive till next week.
A Venetian gentleman was asked if he'd liked travelling. Why should I travel, he exclaimed, when I'm already here. And finally, following off from that, I'd like to know, panel, what quotations you would choose to employ if you were sending a holiday postcard from absolutely anywhere on the globe you care to choose, perhaps commenting on the sort of time you're having. Benny Green, what would you choose?
To a very old holidaymaker, once more onto the beach.
Dear friend.
Yes, from somebody called Shakespeare, Graham Garden.
Well, this will take some telling, this. But I don't know if you've noticed, but the English abroad are obsessed with the plumbing. That if you meet... It's true, isn't it? If you meet an Englishman on the continent, they ask you three questions. One is, where do you come from? Do you know Watford? And what's the plumbing like where you're from? I have in my possession a card that was sent to me by William Blake, the William Blake. I'm going back a few years, of course. But he sent me a postcard. It was the first time he'd been abroad. And he later pinched the lines and used them in his poem Infant Sorrow. But what happened was his parents were very against him going abroad on his own. He said, I'm going to France. And it was terrible. And the people lost his luggage. He had no clothes to wear. He couldn't speak the language. He couldn't do a thing. And worst of all, the plumbing in his hotel was a disgrace. The pipes made a terrible noise the whole night long. And he sent the postcard back to me. He sent the card to me saying, my mother groaned, my father wept. Into the dangerous world I leapt. Helpless, naked, piping loud. Pipes, the piping.
All right.
I don't get it.
Take a big postcard. Norma, what would you put on your postcard?
Well, last year I spent my holiday in Broadcasting House, and the year before that I spent it in Television Centre. So what I do is I write, I do like to be by BBC side. But I have actually written one for luckier people who get a holiday in those flats in Torremolinas that aren't quite built yet and have hot and cold running water and no taps and things like that, and where you climb all the 75 stairs and you would collapse if there were room, but there isn't, so you don't. And I've taken this from Shakespeare, no less, from Macbeth, and it goes like this: bubble bubble toilet trouble.
Ronnie, you're itching to get in with your postcard.
Well, I don't know about after that one. This is by a card on the English Leader. The sand in the porridge and sand in the bed, and if this is pleasure, we'd rather be dead.
Larry Adler, what would you put on your postcard?
Well, first of all, did you know in The Guardian on Friday there was a story that they found a painting called The Toilet of Venus, and guess who painted it? Carl Van Loo. But the postcard that I would send is, having a wonderful time, wish you were her. Or, I feel so awful without you, it's almost like having you here. One more. When are you coming to join me and why?
And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of quote unquote for this week. Let me tell you that by a very narrow margin, Benny Green is this week's winner. Finally, as we've not been concerning ourselves with the famous last words this week, let me tell you with extraordinary trouble some people go to register pre-bucket-kicking remarks. It's reported from New England that as an old gentleman neared his end, a relative or a nurse put her ear down to catch his final words, and the old man, with his very last breath, parted his aged lips and said, "Boo." Goodbye.
Part in Quote Unquote this week with Ari Adler, Graham Garden, Benny Green and Norma Shepherd. Quotations were read by me, Ronald Fletcher. The programme was devised and introduced by Nigel Rees and produced by John Lloyd.